Chapter 8 Snape Victorious. Harry could not move a muscle. He lay there beneath the invisibility cloak, feeling the blood from his nose flow, hot and wet, over his face, listening to the voices and footsteps in the corridor beyond. His immediate thought was that someone, surely, would check the compartments before the train departed again. But at once came the dispiriting realization that even if somebody looked into the compartment, he would be neither seen nor heard. His best hope was that somebody else would walk in and step on him. Harry had never hated Malfoy more than as he lay there, like an absurd turtle on its back, blood dripping sickeningly into his open mouth. What a stupid situation to have landed himself in! And now the last few footsteps were dying away. Everyone was shuffling along the dark platform outside. He could hear the scraping of trunks and the loud babble of talk. Ron and Hermione would think he had left the train without them. Once they arrived at Hogwarts and took their places in the Great Hall, looked up and down the Gryffindor table a few times, and finally realized that he was not there, he, no doubt, would be halfway back to London. He tried to make a sound, even a grunt, but it was impossible. Then he remembered that some wizards, like Dumbledore, could perform spells without speaking. So he tried to summon his wand, which had fallen out of his hand, by saying the words Axio Wand over and over again in his head. But nothing happened. He thought he could hear the rustling of the trees that surrounded the lake and the far-off hoot of an owl, but no hint of a search being made, or even—he despised himself slightly for hoping it—panicked voices wondering where Harry Potter had gone. A feeling of hopelessness spread through him as he imagined the convoy of thestral-drawn carriages trundling up to the school and the muffled yells of laughter issuing from whichever carriage Malfoy was riding in, where he would be recounting his attack on Harry to his fellow Slytherins. The train lurched, causing Harry to roll over onto his side. Now he was staring at the dusty underside of the seats instead of the ceiling. The floor began to vibrate as the engine roared into life. The express was leaving, and nobody knew he was still on it. Then he felt his invisibility cloak fly off him, and a voice overhead said, "Watch her, Harry." There was a flash of red light, and Harry's body unfroze. He was able to push himself into a more dignified sitting position, hastily wipe the blood off his bruised face with the back of his hand, and raise his head to look up at Tonks, who was holding the invisibility cloak she had just pulled away. "We'd better get out of here, quickly," she said, as the train windows became obscured with steam and the train began to move out of the station. "Come on, we'll jump!" Harry hurried after her into the corridor. Tonks pulled open the train door and leapt onto the platform, which seemed to be sliding underneath them as the train gathered momentum. Harry followed her, staggered a little on landing, then straightened up in time to see the gleaming scarlet steam engine pick up speed, round the corner, and disappear from view. The cold night air was soothing on his throbbing nose. Tonks was looking at him. He felt angry and embarrassed that he had been discovered in such a ridiculous position. Silently, she handed him back the invisibility cloak. "Who did it?" "Draco Malfoy," said Harry bitterly. "Thanks for... well..." "No problem," said Tonks, without smiling. From what Harry could see in the darkness, she was as mousy-haired and miserable-looking as she had been when he had met her at the Burrow. "I can fix your nose if you stand still." Harry did not think much of this idea. He had been intending to visit Madame Pumphrey, the matron, in whom he had a little more confidence when it came to healing spells, but it seemed rude to say this, so he stayed stock still and closed his eyes. "Episky," said Tonks. Harry's nose felt very hot, and then very cold. He raised a hand and felt it gingerly. It seemed to be mended. "Thanks a lot. "You'd better put that cloak back on, and we can walk up to the school," said Tonks, still unsmiling. As Harry swung the cloak back over himself, she waved her wand. An immense silvery four-legged creature erupted from it and streaked off into the darkness. "Was that a Patronus?" asked Harry, who had seen Dumbledore send messages like this. "Yes, I'm sending word to the castle that I've got you, or they'll worry. Come on, we better not dawdle." They set off towards the lane that led to the school. "How did you find me?" "I noticed you hadn't left the train, and I knew you had that cloak. I thought you might be hiding for some reason. When I saw the blinds were drawn on that compartment, I thought I'd check." "But what are you doing here anyway?" Harry asked. "I'm stationed in Hogsmeade now, to give the school extra protection," said Tonks. "Is it just you who's stationed up here, or—" "No, Proudfoot, Savage and Dawlish are here too."
"Dawlish? That aura Dumbledore attacked last year?"
"That's right." They trudged up the dark, deserted lane, following the freshly made carriage tracks. Harry looked sideways at Tonks under his cloak. Last year she had been inquisitive, to the point of being a little annoying at times. She had laughed easily. She had made jokes. Now she seemed older and much more serious and purposeful. Was this all the effect of what had happened at the Ministry? He reflected uncomfortably that Hermione would have suggested he say something consoling about Sirius to her, that it hadn't been her fault at all, but he couldn't bring himself to do it. He was far from blaming her for Sirius's death. It was no more her fault than anyone else's, and much less than his. But he did not like talking about Sirius if he could avoid it. And so they tramped on through the cold night in silence, Tonks's long cloak whispering on the ground behind them. Having always travelled there by carriage, Harry had never before appreciated just how far Hogwarts was from Hogsmeade Station. With great relief he finally saw the tall pillars on either side of the gates, each topped with a winged boar. He was cold, he was hungry, and he was quite keen to leave this new, gloomy Tonks behind. But when he put out a hand to push open the gates, he found them chained shut. "Alohomora," he said confidently, pointing his wand at the padlock. But nothing happened.
"That won't work on these," said Tonks. "Dumbledore bewitched them himself."
Harry looked around.
"I could climb a wall," he suggested.
"No, you couldn't," said Tonks flatly. "Anti-intruder jinxes on all of them. Security's been tightened 100-fold this summer."
"Well, then," said Harry, starting to feel annoyed at her lack of helpfulness, "I suppose I'll just have to sleep out here and wait for morning."
"Someone's coming down for you," said Tonks. "Luke!"
A lantern was bobbing at the distant foot of the castle. Harry was so pleased to see it he felt he could even endure Filch's wheezy criticisms of his tardiness and rants about how his timekeeping would improve with the regular application of thumb screws. It was not until the glowing yellow light was 10 feet away from them and Harry had pulled off his invisibility cloak so that he could be seen that he recognised, with a rush of pure loathing, the uplit hooked nose and long black greasy hair of Severus Snape.
"Well, well, well," sneered Snape, taking out his wand and tapping the padlock once, so that the chain snaked backwards and the gates creaked open. "Nice of you to turn up, Potter, although you have evidently decided that the wearing of school robes would detract from your appearance."
"I couldn't change. I didn't have my—"
Harry began, but Snape cut across him.
"There is no need to wait, Nymphadora. Potter is quite, safe in my hands."
"I meant Hagrid to get the message," said Tonks, frowning.
"Hagrid was late for the start of term feast, just like Potter here, so I took it instead. And incidentally," said Snape, standing back to allow Harry to pass him, "I was interested to see your new Patronus."
He shut the gates in her face with a loud clang and tapped the chains with his wand again so that they slithered clinking back into place.
"I think you were better off with the old one," said Snape,
the malice in his voice unmistakable. "The new one looks weak." As Snape swung the lantern about, Harry saw fleetingly a look of shock and anger on Tonks's face. Then she was covered in darkness once more. "Good night," Harry called to her over his shoulder as he began the walk up to the school with Snape. "Thanks for everything.
See you, Harry."
Snape did not speak for a minute or so. Harry felt as though his body was generating waves of hatred so powerful that it seemed incredible that Snape could not feel them burning him. He had loathed Snape from their first encounter, but Snape had placed himself forever and irrevocably beyond the possibility of Harry's forgiveness by his attitude towards Sirius. Whatever Dumbledore said, Harry had had time to think over the summer, and had concluded that Snape's snide remarks to Sirius about remaining safely hidden while the rest of the Order of the Phoenix were fighting Voldemort had probably been a powerful factor in Sirius rushing off to the Ministry the night that he had died. Harry clung to this notion because it enabled him to blame Snape, which felt satisfying, and also because he knew that if anyone was not sorry that Sirius was dead, it was the man now striding next to him in the darkness.
50 points from Gryffindor for lateness, I think, said Snape. And, let me see, another 20 for your muggle attire. You know, I don't believe any house has ever been in negative figures this early in the term. We haven't even started pudding. You might have set a record, Potter.
The fury and hatred bubbling inside Harry seemed to blaze white hot, but he would rather have been immobilized all the way back to London than tell Snape why he was late.
"I suppose you wanted to make an entrance, did you?" Snape continued. "And with no flying car available, you decided that bursting into the Great Hall halfway through the feast ought to create a dramatic effect."
Still Harry remained silent, though he thought his chest might explode. He knew that Snape had come to fetch him for this, for the few minutes when he could needle and torment Harry without anyone else listening. They reached the castle steps at last, and as the great oaken front doors swung open onto the vast flagged entrance hall, a burst of talk and laughter and of tinkling plates and glasses greeted them through the doors standing open into the great hall. Harry wondered whether he could slip his invisibility cloak back on, thereby gaining his seat at the long Gryffindor table, which, inconveniently, was the furthest from the entrance hall, without being noticed. As though he had read Harry's mind, however, Snape said, "No cloak. You can walk in so that everyone sees you, which is what you wanted, I'm sure." Harry turned on the spot and marched straight through the open doors, anything to get away from Snape. The great hall, with its four long house tables and its staff table set at the top of the room, was decorated as usual with floating candles that made the plates below glitter and glow. It was all a shimmering blur to Harry, however, who walked so fast that he was passing the Hufflepuff table before people really started to stare, and by the time they were standing up to get a good look at him, he had spotted Ron and Hermione, sped along the benches towards them, and forced his way in between them.
"Where have you... Blimey! What have you done to your face?"
said Ron, goggling at him along with everyone else in the vicinity.
"Why, what's wrong with it?"
said Harry, grabbing a spoon and squinting at his distorted reflection.
"You're covered in blood," said Hermione. "Come here."
She raised her wand, said, "Turgio," and siphoned off the dried blood.
"Thanks," said Harry, feeling his now clean face. "How's my nose looking?"
"Normal," said Hermione anxiously.
"Why shouldn't it? Harry, what's happened? We've been terrified."
"I'll tell you later," said Harry curtly. He was very conscious that Ginny, Neville, Dean, and Seamus were listening in. Even nearly headless Nick, the Gryffindor ghost, had come floating along the bench to eavesdrop.
"But," said Hermione.
"Not now, Hermione," said Harry in a darkly significant voice. He hoped very much that they would all assume he had been involved in something heroic, preferably involving a couple of Death Eaters and a Dementor. Of course, Malfoy would spread the story as far and wide as he could, but there was always a chance it wouldn't reach too many Gryffindor ears. He reached across Ron for a couple of chicken legs and a handful of chips, but before he could take them, they vanished, to be replaced with puddings. "You missed the sorting anyway," said Hermione, as Ron dived for a large chocolate gâteau. "Hat say anything interesting?" asked Harry, taking a piece of treacle tart. "More of the same, really. Advising us all to unite in the face of our enemies, you know." "Dumbledore mentioned Voldemort at all?" "Not yet, but he always saves his proper speech for after the feast, doesn't he? It can't be long now." "Snape said Hagrid was late for the feast." "You've seen Snape? How come?" said Ron, between frenzied mouthfuls of gâteau. "Bumped into him," said Harry evasively. "Hagrid was only a few minutes late," said Hermione. "Look, he's waving at you, Harry." Harry looked up at the staff table and grinned at Hagrid, who was indeed waving at him. Hagrid had never quite managed to comport himself with the dignity of Professor McGonagall, head of Gryffindor House, the top of whose head came up to somewhere between Hagrid's elbow and shoulder as they were sitting side by side, and who was looking disapproving at this enthusiastic greeting. Harry was surprised to see the divination teacher, Professor Trelawney, sitting on Hagrid's other side. She rarely left her tower room, and he had never seen her at the start-of-term feast before. She looked as odd as ever, glittering with beads and trailing shawls, her eyes magnified to enormous size by her spectacles. Having always considered her a bit of a fraud, Harry had been shocked to discover at the end of the previous term that it had been she who had made the prediction that caused Lord Voldemort to kill Harry's parents and attack Harry himself. The knowledge had made him even less eager to find himself in her company, but thankfully this year he would be dropping divination. Her great beacon-like eyes swiveled in his direction. He hastily looked away towards the Slytherin table. Draco Malfoy was miming the shattering of a nose to raucous laughter and applause. Harry dropped his gaze to his treacle tart, his insides burning again. What he would not give to fight Malfoy one-on-one! "So what did Professor Slughorn want?" Hermione asked. "To know what really happened at the Ministry," said Harry. "Him and everyone else here," sniffed Hermione. "People were interrogating us about it on the train, weren't they, Ron?" "Yeah," said Ron, "all wanting to know if you really are the Chosen One." "There has been much talk on that very subject, even amongst the ghosts," interrupted nearly headless Nick, inclining his barely connected head towards Harry so that it wobbled dangerously on its ruff. "I am considered something of a Potter authority. It is widely known that we are friendly. I have assured the spirit community that I will not pester you for information, however. Harry Potter knows that he can confide in me with complete confidence, I told them. I would rather die than betray his trust." "That's not saying much, seeing as you're already dead," Ron observed.
"Once again you show all the sensitivity of a blunt axe," said nearly headless Nick in affronted tones,
and he rose into the air and glided back towards the far end of the Gryffindor table, just as Dumbledore got to his feet at the staff table. The talk and laughter echoing around the hall died away almost instantly.
"The very best of evenings to you," he said, smiling broadly, his arms opened wide, as though to embrace the whole room.
"What happened to his hand?" gasped Hermione. She was not the only one who had noticed. Dumbledore's right hand was as blackened and dead-looking as it had been on the night he had come to fetch Harry from the Dursleys. Whispers swept the room. Dumbledore, interpreting them correctly, merely smiled and shook his purple and gold sleeve over his injury.
"Nothing to worry about," he said airily. "Now, to our new students, welcome. To our old students, welcome back. Another year full of magical education awaits you.
His hand was like that when I saw him over the summer, Harry whispered to Hermione. I thought he'd have cured it by now, though, or Madame Pomfrey would have done.
It looks as if it's died, said Hermione with a nauseated expression. But there are some injuries you can't cure, old curses, and there are poisons without antidotes.
And Mr. Filch, our caretaker, has asked me to say that there is a blanket ban on any joke items bought at the shop called Weasley's Wizard Wheezes. Those wishing to play for their house Quidditch teams should give their names to their heads of house, as usual. We're also looking for new Quidditch commentators who should do likewise. We are pleased to welcome a new member of staff this year. Professor Slughorn...
Slughorn stood up, his bald head gleaming in the candlelight, his big waistcoated belly casting the table below into shadow.
"Is a former colleague of mine who has agreed to resume his old post of potions master."
Potions? Potions? The word echoed all over the hall as people wondered whether they had heard right.
"Potions?" said Ron and Hermione together, turning to stare at Harry. "But you said..."
"Professor Snape, meanwhile," said Dumbledore, raising his voice so that it carried over all the muttering, "will be taking over the position of Defence Against the Dark Arts teacher."
"No!" said Harry,
so loudly that many heads turned in his direction. He did not care. He was staring up at the staff table, incensed.
How could Snape be given the Defence Against the Dark Arts job after all this time? Hadn't it been widely known for years that Dumbledore did not trust him to do it?
"But, Harry, you said that Slughorn was going to be teaching Defence Against the Dark Arts," said Hermione.
"I thought he was," said Harry,
racking his brains to remember when Dumbledore had told him this. But now that he came to think of it, he was unable to recall Dumbledore ever telling him what Slughorn would be teaching. Snape, who was sitting on Dumbledore's right, did not stand up at the mention of his name, merely raised a hand in lazy acknowledgement of the applause from the Slytherin table. Yet Harry was sure he could detect a look of triumph on the features he loathed so much.
"Well, there's one good thing," he said savagely. "Snape'll be gone by the end of the year."
"What do you mean?" asked Ron. "That job's jinxed. No one's lasted more than a year. Quirrell actually died doing it. Personally, I'm going to keep my fingers crossed for another death."
"Harry,"
said Hermione, shocked and reproachful.
"He might just go back to teaching potions at the end of the year," said Ron reasonably. "That Slughorn bloke might not want to stay long term. Moody didn't."
Dumbledore cleared his throat. Harry, Ron and Hermione were not the only ones who had been talking. The whole hall had erupted in a buzz of conversation at the news that Snape had finally achieved his heart's desire. Seemingly oblivious to the sensational nature of the news he had just imparted, Dumbledore said nothing more about staff appointments, but waited a few seconds to ensure that the silence was absolute before continuing.
"Now, as everybody in this hall knows, Lord Voldemort and his followers are once more at large and gaining in strength."
The silence seemed to tauten and strain as Dumbledore spoke. Harry glanced at Malfoy. Malfoy was not looking at Dumbledore, but making his fork hover in midair with his wand, as though he found the headmaster's words unworthy of his attention.
"I cannot emphasize strongly enough how dangerous the present situation is, and how much care each of us at Hogwarts must take to ensure that we remain safe. The castle's magical fortifications have been strengthened over the summer. We are protected in new and more powerful ways, but we must still guard scrupulously against carelessness on the part of any student or member of staff. I urge you, therefore, to abide by any security restrictions that your teachers might impose upon you, however irksome you might find them. In particular,
the rule that you are not to be out of bed after hours. I implore you, should you notice anything strange or suspicious within or outside the castle, to report it to a member of staff immediately. I trust you to conduct yourselves always with the utmost regard for your own and each other's safety." Dumbledore's blue eyes swept over the students before he smiled once more. "But now your beds await, as warm and comfortable as you could possibly wish, and I know that your top priority is to be well rested for your lessons tomorrow. Let us therefore say good night. Pip, pip." With the usual deafening, scraping noise, the benches were moved back, and the hundreds of students began to file out of the great hall towards their dormitories. Harry, who was in no hurry at all to leave with the gawping crowd, nor to get near enough to Malfoy to allow him to retell the story of the nose-stamping, lagged behind, pretending to retie the lace on his trainer, allowing most of the Gryffindors to draw ahead of him. Hermione had darted ahead to fulfil her prefect's duty of shepherding the first years, but Ron remained with Harry. "What really happened to your nose?" he asked, once they were at the very back of the throng pressing out of the hall and out of earshot of anyone else. Harry told him. It was a mark of the strength of their friendship that Ron did not laugh. "I saw Malfoy miming something to do with a nose," he said darkly. "Yeah, well, never mind that," said Harry bitterly. "Listen to what he was saying before he found out I was there." Harry had expected Ron to be stunned by Malfoy's boasts. With what Harry considered pure pig-headedness, however, Ron was unimpressed. "Come on, Harry. He was just showing off for Parkinson. What kind of mission would you-know-who have given him? How do you know Voldemort doesn't need someone at Hogwarts? It wouldn't be the first—" "I wish you'd stop saying that name, Harry," said a reproachful voice behind them. Harry looked over his shoulder to see Hagrid shaking his head. "Dumbledore uses that name," said Harry stubbornly. "Yeah, well, that's Dumbledore, innit?" said Hagrid mysteriously. "So how come you were late, Harry? I was worried." "Got held up on the train," said Harry. "Why were you late?" "I was with Grawp," said Hagrid happily. "Lost track of the time. He's got a new home up in the mountains now. Dumbledore fixed it. Nice big cave. He's much happier than he was in the forest. We were having a good chat." "Really?" said Harry, taking care not to catch Ron's eye. The last time he had met Hagrid's half-brother, a vicious giant with a talent for ripping up trees by the roots, his vocabulary had comprised 5 words, 2 of which he was unable to pronounce properly. "Oh, yeah, he's really come on," said Hagrid proudly. "You'd be amazed. I'm thinking of training him up as me assistant." Ron snorted loudly, but managed to pass it off as a violent sneeze. They were now standing beside the oak front doors. "Anyway, I'll see you tomorrow. First lesson straight after lunch. Come early, and you can say hello to Witherwings. Raising an arm in cheery farewell, he headed out of the front doors into the darkness. Harry and Ron looked at each other. Harry could tell that Ron was experiencing the same sinking feeling as himself. "You're not taking care of magical creatures, are you?" Ron shook his head. "And you're not either, are you?" Harry shook his head too. "And Hermione," said Ron, "she's not, is she?" Harry shook his head again. Exactly what Hagrid would say when he realized his 3 favorite students had given up his subject, he did not like to think. Chapter 9 The Half-Blood Prince. Harry and Ron met Hermione in the common room before breakfast next morning. Hoping for some support for his theory, Harry lost no time in telling Hermione what he had overheard Malfoy saying on the Hogwarts Express.
"But he was obviously showing off for Parkinson, wasn't he?" interjected Ron quickly, before Hermione could say anything.
"Well," she said uncertainly, "I don't know. It would be like Malfoy to make himself seem more important than he is. But that's a big lie to tell."
"Exactly," said Harry. But he could not press the point, because so many people were trying to listen in to his conversation, not to mention staring at him and whispering behind their hands.
"It's rude to point," Ron snapped at a particularly minuscule first year as they joined the queue to climb out of the portrait hole.
The boy, who had been muttering something about Harry behind his hand to his friend, promptly turned scarlet and toppled out of the hole in alarm. Ron sniggered.
"I love being a sixth year. And we're going to be getting free time this year. Whole periods when we can just sit up here and relax."
"We're going to need that time for studying, Ron," said Hermione, as they set off down the corridor.
"Yeah, but not today," said Ron. "Today's going to be a real doss, I reckon."
"Hold it," said Hermione, throwing out an arm and halting a passing fourth year, who was attempting to push past her with a lime-green disc clutched tightly in his hand.
"Fanged frisbees are banned. Hand it over," she told him sternly.
The scowling boy handed over the snarling frisbee, ducked under Hermione's arm, and took off after his friends. Ron waited for him to vanish, then tugged the frisbee from Hermione's grip.
"Excellent! I've always wanted one of these."
Hermione's remonstration was drowned by a loud giggle. Lavender Brown had apparently found Ron's remark highly amusing. She continued to laugh as she passed them, glancing back at Ron over her shoulder. Ron looked rather pleased with himself. The ceiling of the great hall was serenely blue and streaked with frail, wispy clouds, just like the squares of sky visible through the high, mullioned windows. While they tucked into porridge and eggs and bacon, Harry and Ron told Hermione about their embarrassing conversation with Hagrid the previous evening.
"But he can't really think we'd continue care of magical creatures," she said, looking distressed. "I mean, when has any of us expressed, you know, any enthusiasm?"
"That's it, though, isn't it?"
said Ron, swallowing an entire fried egg whole. "We were the ones who made the most effort in classes because we like Hagrid, but he thinks we like the stupid subject. Do you reckon anyone's going to go on to NEWT?" Neither Harry nor Hermione answered. There was no need. They knew perfectly well that nobody in their year would want to continue care of magical creatures. They avoided Hagrid's eye and returned his cheery wave only half-heartedly when he left the staff table 10 minutes later. After they had eaten, they remained in their places, awaiting Professor McGonagall's descent from the staff table. The distribution of timetables was more complicated than usual this year, for Professor McGonagall needed first to confirm that everybody had achieved the necessary OWL grades to continue with their chosen NEWTs. Hermione was immediately cleared to continue with Charms, Defence Against the Dark Arts, Transfiguration, Herbology, Arithmancy, Ancient Runes and Potions, and shot off to a first period Ancient Runes class without further ado. Neville took a little longer to sort out. His round face was anxious as Professor McGonagall looked down his application and then consulted his OWL results.
"Herbology, fine," she said. "Professor Sprout will be delighted to see you back with an outstanding OWL, and you qualify for Defence Against the Dark Arts with Exceeds Expectations, but the problem is Transfiguration. I'm sorry, Longbottom, but an acceptable really isn't good enough to continue to any WT level. I just don't think you'd be able to cope with the coursework."
Neville hung his head. Professor McGonagall peered at him through her square spectacles.
"Why do you want to continue with Transfiguration anyway? I've never had the impression that you particularly enjoyed it."
Neville looked miserable and muttered something about "my grandmother once."
"Humph!" snorted Professor McGonagall. "It's high time your grandmother learned to be proud of the grandson she's got, rather than the one she thinks she ought to have, particularly after what happened at the Ministry."
Neville turned very pink and blinked confusedly. Professor McGonagall had never paid him a compliment before.
"I'm sorry, Longbottom, but I cannot let you into my NEWT class. I see that you have an exceeds expectations in charms, however. Why not try for an NEWT in charms?"
"My grandmother thinks charms is a soft option," mumbled Neville.
"Take charms," said Professor McGonagall, "and I shall drop Augusta a line, reminding her that just because she failed her charms, OWL, the subject is not necessarily worthless."
Smiling slightly at the look of delighted incredulity on Neville's face, Professor McGonagall tapped a blank timetable with the tip of her wand and handed it, now carrying details of his new classes, to Neville. Professor McGonagall turned next to Parvati Patil, whose first question was whether Firenze, the handsome centaur, was still teaching divination.
"He and Professor Trelawney are dividing classes between them this year," said Professor McGonagall, a hint of disapproval in her voice. It was common knowledge that she despised the subject of divination. "The sixth year is being taken by Professor Trelawney."
Parvati set off for divination 5 minutes later, looking slightly crestfallen.
"So, Potter, Potter," said Professor McGonagall, consulting her notes as she turned to Harry. "Charms, defence against the dark arts, herbology, transfiguration, all fine. I must say I was pleased with your transfiguration mark, Potter, very pleased. Now, why haven't you applied to continue with potions? I thought it was your ambition to become an auror."
"It was, but you told me I had to get an outstanding in my OWL, Professor."
"And so you did when Professor Snape was teaching the subject. Professor Slughorn, however, is perfectly happy to accept NEWT students with exceeds expectations at OWL. Do you wish to proceed with potions?"
"Yes," said Harry, "but I didn't buy the books or any ingredients or anything."
"I'm sure Professor Slughorn will be able to lend you some," said Professor McGonagall. "Very well, Potter. Here is your timetable. Oh, by the way, 20 hopefuls have already put down their names for the Gryffindor Quidditch team. I shall pass the list to you in due course, and you can fix up trials at your leisure."
A few minutes later, Ron was cleared to do the same subjects as Harry, and the two of them left the table together.
"Look," said Ron delightedly, gazing at his timetable. "We've got a free period now, and a free period after break, and after lunch. Excellent."
They returned to the common room, which was empty, apart from half a dozen seventh years, including Katie Bell, the only remaining member of the original Gryffindor Quidditch team that Harry had joined in his first year.
"I thought you'd get that. Well done,"
she called over, pointing at the captain's badge on Harry's chest.
"Tell me when you call trials."
"Don't be stupid," said Harry. "You don't need to try out. I've watched you play for 5 years."
"You mustn't start off like that," she said warningly. "For all you know, there's someone much better than me out there. Good teams have been ruined before now because captains just kept playing the old faces or letting in their friends."
Ron looked a little uncomfortable and began playing with the fanged frisbee Hermione had taken from the fourth year. It zoomed around the common room, snarling and attempting to take bites of the tapestry. Crookshank's yellow eyes followed it, and he hissed when it came too close. An hour later, they reluctantly left the sunlit common room for the defence against the dark arts classroom 4 floors below. Hermione was already queuing outside, carrying an armful of heavy books and looking put upon.
"We've got so much homework for runes," she said anxiously, when Harry and Ron joined her. "A 15-inch essay, 2 translations, and I've got to read these by Wednesday."
"Shame," yawned Ron.
"You wait," she said resentfully. "I bet Snape gives us loads."
The classroom door opened as she spoke, and Snape stepped into the corridor, his sallow face framed as ever by 2 curtains of greasy black hair. Silence fell over the queue immediately.
"Inside," he said.
Harry looked around as they entered. Snape had imposed his personality upon the room already. It was gloomier than usual, as curtains had been drawn over the windows and was lit by candlelight.
New pictures adorned the walls, many of them showing people who appeared to be in pain, sporting grisly injuries or strangely contorted body parts. Nobody spoke as they settled down, looking around at the shadowy, gruesome pictures.
"I have not asked you to take out your books," said Snape, closing the door and moving to face the class from behind his desk. Hermione hastily dropped her copy of Confronting the Faceless back into her bag and stowed it under her chair. "I wish to speak to you, and I want your fullest attention."
His black eyes roved over their upturned faces, lingering for a fraction of a second longer on Harry's than anyone else's.
"You have had 5 teachers in this subject so far, I believe?"
"You believe? Like you haven't watched them all come and go, Snape, hoping you'd be next," thought Harry scathingly.
"Naturally, these teachers will all have had their own methods and priorities. Given this confusion, I am surprised so many of you scraped an OWL in this subject. I shall be even more surprised if all of you manage to keep up with the NEWT work, which will be much more advanced."
Snape set off around the edge of the room, speaking now in a lower voice. The class craned their necks to keep him in view. "The dark arts," said Snape, "are many, varied, ever-changing and eternal. Fighting them is like fighting a many-headed monster, which, each time a neck is severed, sprouts a head even fiercer and cleverer than before. You are fighting that which is unfixed, mutating, indestructible." Harry stared at Snape. It was surely one thing to respect the dark arts as a dangerous enemy, another to speak of them, as Snape was doing, with a loving caress in his voice.
"Your defences," said Snape a little louder, "must therefore be as flexible and inventive as the arts you seek to undo. These pictures," he indicated a few of them as he swept past, "give a fair representation of what happens to those who suffer, for instance, the Cruciatus curse." He waved a hand towards a witch who was clearly shrieking in agony. "Feel the Dementor's kiss?" A wizard lying huddled and blank-eyed, slumped against a wall. "Or provoke the aggression of the Inferius?" A bloody mass upon the ground.
"Has an Inferius been seen, then?" said Parvati Patil in a high-pitched voice. "Is it definite? Is he using them?"
"The Dark Lord has used Inferi in the past," said Snape, "which means you would be well advised to assume he might use them again. Now,"
he set off again around the other side of the classroom towards his desk, and again the class watched him as he walked, his dark robes billowing behind him.
"You are, I believe, complete novices in the use of non-verbal spells. What is the advantage of a non-verbal spell?"
Hermione's hand shot into the air. Snape took his time looking around at everybody else, making sure he had no choice, before saying curtly, "Very well, Miss Granger."
"Your adversary has no warning about what kind of magic you're about to perform," said Hermione, "which gives you a split-second advantage."
"An answer copied almost word for word from the Standard Book of Spells, Grade 6, said Snape dismissively. Over in the corner, Malfoy sniggered. "But correct in essentials. Yes, those who progress to using magic without shouting incantations gain an element of surprise in their spell casting. Not all wizards can do this, of course. It is a question of concentration and mind power, which some," his gaze lingered maliciously upon Harry once more, "lack."
Harry knew Snape was thinking of their disastrous occlumency lessons of the previous year. He refused to drop his gaze, but glowered at Snape until Snape looked away.
"You will now divide," Snape went on, "into pairs. One partner will attempt to jinx the other without speaking. The other will attempt to repel the jinx in equal silence. Carry on."
Although Snape did not know it,
Harry had taught at least half the class, everyone who had been a member of the DA, how to perform a shield charm the previous year. None of them had ever cast the charm without speaking, however. A reasonable amount of cheating ensued. Many people were merely whispering the incantation instead of saying it aloud. Typically, 10 minutes into the lesson, Hermione managed to repel Neville's muttered jellylegs jinx without uttering a single word, a feat that would surely have earned her 20 points for Gryffindor from any reasonable teacher, thought Harry bitterly, but which Snape ignored. He swept between them as they practised, looking just as much like an overgrown bat as ever, lingering to watch Harry and Ron struggling with the task. Ron, who was supposed to be jinxing Harry, was purple in the face, his lips tightly compressed to save himself from the temptation of muttering the incantation. Harry had his wand raised, waiting on tenterhooks to repel a jinx that seemed unlikely ever to come. "Pathetic, Weasley," said Snape after a while. "Here, let me show you." He turned his wand on Harry so fast that Harry reacted instinctively. All thought of non-verbal spells forgotten, he yelled, "Protego!" His shield charm was so strong, Snape was knocked off balance and hit a desk. The whole class had looked round and now watched as Snape righted himself, scowling. "Do you remember me telling you we are practising non-verbal spells, Potter?" "Yes," said Harry stiffly. "Yes, sir." "There's no need to call me sir, Professor." The words had escaped him before he knew what he was saying. Several people gasped, including Hermione. Behind Snape, however, Ron, Dean and Seamus grinned appreciatively. "Detention. Saturday night, my office," said Snape. "I do not take cheek from anyone, Potter, not even the Chosen One." "That was brilliant, Harry," chortled Ron, once they were safely on their way to break a short while later. "You really shouldn't have said it," said Hermione, frowning at Ron. "What made you?" "He tried to jinx me, in case you didn't notice," fumed Harry. "I had enough of that during those occlumency lessons. Why doesn't he use another guinea pig for a change? What's Dumbledore playing at, anyway, letting him teach defence? Did you hear him talking about the dark arts? He loves them. All that unfixed, indestructible stuff." "Well," said Hermione, "I thought he sounded a bit like you." "Like me?" "Yes, when you were telling us what it's like to face Voldemort, you said it wasn't just memorising a bunch of spells. You said it was just you and your brains and your guts. Well, wasn't that what Snape was saying? That it really comes down to being brave and quick-thinking?" Harry was so disarmed that she had thought his words as well worth memorising as the standard book of spells that he did not argue.
"Harry! Hey, Harry!"
Harry looked round. Jack Sloper, one of the beaters on the previous year's Gryffindor Quidditch team, was hurrying towards him, holding a roll of parchment.
"For you," panted Sloper. "Listen, I heard you're the new captain. When are you holding trials?"
"I'm not sure yet," said Harry, thinking privately that Sloper would be very lucky to get back on the team. "I'll let you know."
"Oh, right. I was hoping it'd be this weekend."
But Harry was not listening. He had just recognised the thin, slanting writing on the parchment. Leaving Sloper in mid-sentence, he hurried away with Ron and Hermione, unrolling the parchment as he went. "Dear Harry, I would like to start our private lessons this Saturday. Kindly come along to my office at 8 p.m. I hope you are enjoying your first day back at school. Yours sincerely, Albus Dumbledore. P.S. I enjoy acid pops." "He enjoys acid pops," said Ron, who had read the message over Harry's shoulder and was looking perplexed. "It's the password to get past the gargoyle outside his study," said Harry in a low voice. "Ha! Snape's not going to be pleased. I won't be able to do his detention." He, Ron and Hermione spent the whole of break speculating on what Dumbledore would teach Harry.
Ron thought it most likely to be spectacular jinxes and hexes of the type the Death Eaters would not know. Hermione said such things were illegal, and thought it much more likely that Dumbledore wanted to teach Harry advanced defensive magic. After break, she went off to arithmancy, while Harry and Ron returned to the common room, where they grudgingly started Snape's homework. This turned out to be so complex that they still had not finished when Hermione joined them for their after-lunch free period, though she considerably speeded up the process. They had only just finished when the bell rang for the afternoon's double potions, and they beat the familiar path down to the dungeon classroom that had, for so long, been Snape's. When they arrived in the corridor, they saw that there were only a dozen people progressing to NEWT level. Crabbe and Goyle had evidently failed to achieve the required OWL grade, but four Slytherins had made it through, including Malfoy. Four Ravenclaws were there, and one Hufflepuff, Ernie Macmillan, whom Harry liked, despite his rather pompous manner.
"Harry," Ernie said portentously, holding out his hand as Harry approached. "Didn't get a chance to speak in Defence Against the Dark Arts this morning. Good lesson, I thought. But shield charms are old hat, of course, for us old DA lags. And how are you, Ron, Hermione?"
Before they could say more than fine, the dungeon door opened, and Slughorn's belly preceded him out of the door. As they filed into the room, his great walrus moustache curved above his beaming mouth, and he greeted Harry and Zabini with particular enthusiasm. The dungeon was, most unusually, already full of vapours and odd smells. Harry, Ron and Hermione sniffed interestedly as they passed large, bubbling cauldrons. The four Slytherins took a table together, as did the four Ravenclaws. This left Harry, Ron and Hermione to share a table with Ernie. They chose the one nearest a gold-coloured cauldron that was emitting one of the most seductive scents Harry had ever inhaled. Somehow it reminded him simultaneously of treacle tart, the woody smell of a broomstick handle, and something flowery he thought he might have smelled at the Burrow. He found that he was breathing very slowly and deeply, and that the potion's fumes seemed to be filling him up like drink. A great contentment stole over him. He grinned across at Ron, who grinned lazily back.
"Now then, now then, now then," said Slughorn, whose massive outline was quivering through the many shimmering vapours. "Scales out, everyone, and potion kits, and don't forget your copies of Advanced Potion Making."
"Sir," said Harry, raising his hand.
"Harry, my boy?"
"I haven't got a book or scales or anything, nor's Ron. We didn't realise we'd be able to do the NEWT, you see."
"Ah, yes, Professor McGonagall did mention not to worry, my dear boy, not to worry at all. You can use ingredients from the store cupboard today, and I'm sure we can lend you some scales, and we've got a small stock of old books here. They'll do until you can write to Flourish and Blotts."
Slughorn strode over to a corner cupboard, and after a moment's foraging, emerged with two very battered-looking copies of Advanced Potion Making by Libatius Borridge, which he gave to Harry and Ron, along with two sets of tarnished scales.
"Now then," said Slughorn, returning to the front of the class and inflating his already bulging chest, so that the buttons on his waistcoat threatened to burst off. "I've prepared a few potions for you to have a look at, just out of interest, you know. These are the kind of thing you ought to be able to make after completing your NEWTs. You ought to have heard of them, even if you haven't made them yet. Anyone tell me what this one is?"
He indicated the cauldron nearest the Slytherin table. Harry raised himself slightly in his seat and saw what looked like plain water boiling away inside it. Hermione's well-practised hand hit the air before anybody else's. Slughorn pointed at her.
"It's Veritaserum, a colourless, odourless potion that forces the drinker to tell the truth," said Hermione.
"Very good, very good," said Slughorn happily. "Now," he continued, pointing at the cauldron nearest the Ravenclaw table, "this one here is pretty well known, featured in a few ministry leaflets lately, too. Who can—"
Hermione's hand was fastest once more.
"It's Polyjuice Potion, sir," she said.
Harry, too, had recognised the slow-bubbling, mud-like substance in the second cauldron, but did not resent Hermione getting the credit for answering the question. She, after all, was the one who had succeeded in making it back in their second year.
"Excellent, excellent. Now, this one here—"
"Yes, my dear?"
said Slughorn, now looking slightly bemused as Hermione's hand punched the air again.
"It's Amortentia."
"It is indeed. It seems almost foolish to ask," said Slughorn, who was looking mightily impressed.
"But I assume you know what it does."
"It's the most powerful love potion in the world," said Hermione.
"Quite right. You recognised it, I suppose, by its distinctive mother-of-pearl sheen?"
"And the steam rising in characteristic spirals," said Hermione enthusiastically. "And it's supposed to smell differently to each of us, according to what attracts us. And I can smell freshly mown grass and new parchment and—"
But she turned slightly pink and did not complete the sentence.
"May I ask your name, my dear?"
said Slughorn, ignoring Hermione's embarrassment.
"Hermione Granger, sir."
"Granger, Granger? Can you possibly be related to Hector Dagworth Granger, who founded the Most Extraordinary Society of Potioneers?"
"No, I don't think so, sir. I'm Muggle-born, you see."
Harry saw Malfoy lean close to Knott and whisper something. Both of them sniggered. But Slughorn showed no dismay. On the contrary, he beamed and looked from Hermione to Harry, who was sitting next to her.
"Oh, ho! One of my best friends is Muggle-born, and she's the best in our year. I'm assuming this is the very friend of whom you spoke, Harry."
"Yes, sir," said Harry.
"Well, well, take 20 well-earned points for Gryffindor, Miss Granger," said Slughorn genially.
Malfoy looked rather as he had done the time Hermione had punched him in the face. Hermione turned to Harry with a radiant expression and whispered,
"Did you really tell him I'm the best in the year? Oh, Harry!"
"Well, what's so impressive about that?" whispered Ron, who for some reason looked annoyed.
"You are the best in the year. I'd have told him so if he'd asked me."
Hermione smiled, but made a shushing gesture, so that they could hear what Slughorn was saying. Ron looked slightly disgruntled.
"Amortentia doesn't really create love, of course. It is impossible to manufacture or imitate love. No, this will simply cause a powerful infatuation or obsession. It is probably the most dangerous and powerful potion in this room." "Oh, yes,"
he said, nodding gravely at Malfoy and Knott, both of whom were smirking sceptically.
"When you have seen as much of life as I have, you will not underestimate the power of obsessive love." "And now," said Slughorn, "it is time for us to start work."
"Sir, you haven't told us what's in this one," said Ernie Macmillan, pointing at a small black cauldron standing on Slughorn's desk.
The potion within was splashing about merrily. It was the colour of molten gold, and large drops were leaping like goldfish above the surface, though not a particle had spilled.
"Oh, ho!" said Slughorn again.
Harry was sure that Slughorn had not forgotten the potion at all, but had waited to be asked for dramatic effect.
"Yes, that. Well, that one, ladies and gentlemen, is a most curious little potion called Felix Felicis. I take it,"
he turned smiling to look at Hermione, who had let out an audible gasp,
"that you know what Felix Felicis does, Miss Granger." "It's liquid luck," said Hermione excitedly. "It makes you lucky."
The whole class seemed to sit up a little straighter. Now all Harry could see of Malfoy was the back of his sleek blonde head, because he was at last giving Slughorn his full and undivided attention.
"Quite right. Take another 10 points for Gryffindor. Yes, it's a funny little potion, Felix Felicis," said Slughorn. "Desperately tricky to make, and disastrous to get wrong. However, if brewed correctly, as this has been, you will find that all your endeavours tend to succeed, at least until the effects wear off."
"'Why don't people drink it all the time, sir?'
said Terry Boot eagerly.
"'Because, if taken in excess, it causes giddiness, recklessness, and dangerous overconfidence,' said Slughorn. "'Too much of a good thing, you know. Highly toxic in large quantities, but taken sparingly and very occasionally.'
"'Have you ever taken it, sir?' asked Michael Corner with great interest.
"'Twice in my life,' said Slughorn. "'Once when I was 24, once when I was 57. 2 tablespoonfuls taken with breakfast. 2 perfect days.'
He gazed dreamily into the distance. Whether he was play-acting or not, thought Harry, the effect was good.
"'And that,' said Slughorn, apparently coming back to earth, "'is what I shall be offering as a prize in this lesson.'
There was a silence in which every bubble and gurgle of the surrounding potions seemed magnified tenfold.
"'One tiny bottle of Felix Felicis,' said Slughorn, taking a minuscule glass bottle with a cork in it out of his pocket and showing it to them all. "'Enough for 12 hours' luck.' From dawn till dusk, you will be lucky in everything you attempt. Now, I must give you warning that Felix Felicis is a banned substance in organized competitions, sporting events, for instance, examinations, or elections. So the winner is to use it on an ordinary day only, and watch how that ordinary day becomes extraordinary. So, said Slughorn, suddenly brisk, "'How are you to win my fabulous prize? "'Well, by turning to page 10 of Advanced Potion Making. "'We have a little over an hour left to us, "'which should be time for you to make a decent attempt "'at the draft of living death. "'I know it is more complex than anything you have attempted before, "'and I do not expect a perfect potion from anybody. "'The person who does best, however, will win little Felix here. "'Off you go!'
There was a scraping as everyone drew their cauldrons towards them, and some loud clunks as people began adding weights to their scales. But nobody spoke. The concentration within the room was almost tangible. Harry saw Malfoy riffling feverishly through his copy of Advanced Potion Making. It could not have been clearer that Malfoy really wanted that lucky day. Harry bent swiftly over the tattered book Slughorn had lent him. To his annoyance, he saw that the previous owner had scribbled all over the pages, so that the margins were as black as the printed portions. Bending low to decipher the ingredients, even here the previous owner had made annotations and crossed things out, Harry hurried off towards the store cupboard to find what he needed. As he dashed back to his cauldron, he saw Malfoy cutting up valerian roots as fast as he could. Everyone kept glancing around at what the rest of the class was doing. This was both an advantage and a disadvantage of potions, that it was hard to keep your work private. Within 10 minutes the whole place was full of bluish steam. Hermione, of course, seemed to have progressed furthest. Her potion already resembled the smooth, blackcurrant-coloured liquid mentioned as the ideal halfway stage. Having finished chopping his roots, Harry bent low over his book again. It was really very irritating having to try and decipher the directions under all the stupid scribbles of the previous owner, who for some reason had taken issue with the order to cut up the sapophorus bean and had written in the alternative instruction, "Crush with flat side of silver dagger releases juices better than cutting." "Sir, I think you knew my grandfather, Abraxas Malfoy." Harry looked up. Slughorn was just passing the Slytherin table.
"Yes," said Slughorn without looking at Malfoy. "I was sorry to hear he had died, although, of course, it wasn't unexpected. Dragon pox at his age."
And he walked away. Harry bent back over his cauldron, smirking. He could tell that Malfoy had expected to be treated like Harry or Zabini, perhaps even hoped for some preferential treatment of the type he had learned to expect from Snape. It looked as though Malfoy would have to rely on nothing but talent
to win the bottle of Felix Felicis. The Sopophorus bean was proving very difficult to cut up. Harry turned to Hermione. "Can I borrow your silver knife?" She nodded impatiently, not taking her eyes off her potion, which was still deep purple, though, according to the book, ought to be turning a light shade of lilac by now. Harry crushed his bean with the flat side of the dagger. To his astonishment, it immediately exuded so much juice he was amazed the shriveled bean could have held it all. Hastily scooping it all into the cauldron, he saw, to his surprise, that the potion immediately turned exactly the shade of lilac described by the textbook. His annoyance with the previous owner vanishing on the spot, Harry now squinted at the next line of instructions. According to the book, he had to stir counterclockwise until the potion turned clear as water. According to the addition the previous owner had made, however, he ought to add a clockwise stir after every seventh counterclockwise stir. Could the old owner be right twice? Harry stirred counterclockwise, held his breath, and stirred once clockwise. The effect was immediate. The potion turned palest pink. "How are you doing that?" demanded Hermione, who was red-faced and whose hair was growing bushier and bushier in the fumes from her cauldron. Her potion was still resolutely purple. "Add a clockwise stir." "No, no, the book says counterclockwise," she snapped. Harry shrugged and continued what he was doing. Seven stirs counterclockwise, one clockwise. Pause. Seven stirs counterclockwise, one stir clockwise. Across the table, Ron was cursing fluently under his breath. His potion looked like liquid licorice. Harry glanced around. As far as he could see, no one else's potion had turned as pale as his. He felt elated, something that had certainly never happened before in this dungeon.
"And time's up!" called Slughorn. "Stop staring, please!"
Slughorn moved slowly between the tables, peering into cauldrons. He made no comment, but occasionally gave the potions a stir or a sniff. At last, he reached the table where Harry, Ron, Hermione, and Ernie were sitting. He smiled ruefully at the tar-like substance in Ron's cauldron. He passed over Ernie's navy concoction. Hermione's potion he gave an approving nod. Then he saw Harry's, and a look of incredulous delight spread over his face.
"The clear winner!" he cried to the dungeon. "Excellent, excellent, Harry! Good Lord, it's clear you've inherited your mother's talent. She was a dab hand at potions, Lily was. Here you are, then. Here you are. One bottle of Felix Felicis, as promised. And use it well."
Harry slipped the tiny bottle of golden liquid into his inner pocket, feeling an odd combination of delight at the furious looks on the Slytherins' faces and guilt at the disappointed expression on Hermione's. Ron looked simply dumbfounded.
"How did you do that?"
he whispered to Harry as they left the dungeon.
"Got lucky, I suppose,"
said Harry, because Malfoy was within earshot. Once they were safely ensconced at the Gryffindor table for dinner, however, he felt safe enough to tell them. Hermione's face became stonier with every word he uttered.
"I suppose you think I cheated," he finished, aggravated by her expression.
"Well, it wasn't exactly your own work, was it?" she said stiffly.
"He only followed different instructions to ours," said Ron. "Could have been a catastrophe, couldn't it? But he took a risk, and it paid off."
He heaved a sigh. "Slughorn could have handed me that book, but no, I get the one no one's ever written in. Puked on, by the look of page 52, but
hang on," said a voice close by Harry's left ear, and he caught a sudden waft of that flowery smell he had picked up in Slughorn's dungeon. He looked round and saw that Ginny had joined them.
"Did I hear right?
"You've been taking orders from something someone wrote in a book, Harry?"
She looked alarmed and angry. Harry knew what was on her mind at once.
"It's nothing," he said reassuringly, lowering his voice. "It's not like, you know, Riddle's diary. It's just an old textbook someone scribbled in." "But you're doing what it says." "I just tried a few of the tips written in the margins. Honestly, Ginny, there's nothing funny."
"Ginny's got a point," said Hermione, perking up at once.
"We ought to check that there's nothing odd about it. I mean, all these funny instructions, who knows?"
"Hey," said Harry indignantly, as she pulled his copy of Advanced Potion Making out of his bag and raised her wand.
"Specialis Revelio," she said, rapping it smartly on the front cover.
Nothing whatsoever happened. The book simply lay there, looking old and dirty and dog-eared.
"Finished?" said Harry irritably. "Or do you want to wait and see if it does a few backflips?"
"It seems all right," said Hermione, still staring at the book suspiciously. "I mean, it really does seem to be just a textbook."
"Good, then I'll have it back," said Harry, snatching it off the table, but it slipped from his hand and landed open on the floor.
Nobody else was looking. Harry bent low to retrieve the book, and as he did so, he saw something scribbled along the bottom of the back cover in the same small, cramped handwriting as the instructions that had won him his bottle of Felix Felicis, now safely hidden inside a pair of socks in his trunk upstairs. "This book is the property of the Half-Blood Prince."